So as we begin the seventh chapter of Genesis, verse 1 says, And the Lord said unto Noah, Come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteousness before me in this generation. Because Noah had demonstrated faith, Hebrews 11:7, in God's word, making his faith known by not faltering and obeying God's commandments, God saw or counted him as righteous and saved both him and his house. It's important that God said, come into the ark, not go. God would be in the ark with them. And although the flood would soon be unleashed in devastating fury, they were all safe with him in the ark. Even though it was because of Noah's faith and obedience that God gave the promise concerning his house, even so, each member of that household also demonstrated saving faith as well. Each one chose to voluntarily enter the ark and leave the world in which they had lived for so long. Noah was most likely a man of great wealth, with his long life and being able to finance the building of the ark, but he and his sons and their wives willingly left it all behind because of their faith that God would perform what he promised. There's a balance between man's free choice and God's saving grace, which the limited understanding of man can never fully comprehend, but both man's choice and God's electing grace have a part in man's salvation. God promised Noah that his family would be saved, chapter 6:18, long before they voluntarily chose to enter the ark, chapter 7:7, but when the time came to make the choice, they did choose correctly, and we have a very similar choice to make for ourselves today. It's simply a matter of knowing what God's will is and then carrying out the command of God, just like Noah did. So verses 2 and 3 of Genesis 7 say, Of every clean beast shalt thou take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female. Of fowls also of the air by sevens, the male and the female, to keep seed alive upon the face of the earth. Immediately after telling Noah the time had come, God instructed him to take seven of each clean animal, along with the pairs of all the others, onto the ark, to keep the seed alive upon the face of all the earth, he says. The purpose stated here was very valid if this were to be a universal flood. But if only a local or partial flood, there would be no good reason to give these instructions to Noah. Any flood less than a universal flood would not threaten the life of the seed upon the face of all the earth. The clean animals included some beasts and birds, but no creeping thing. Probably the clean animals were those suitable for domestication and to be a helper to man, and also acceptable for sacrificial offerings to worship God and provide atonement for man. The three pairs would allow greater numerical proliferation of the clean animals after the flood. To be numerically even with man and his three surviving families, this would also allow for a greater variety of genetic factors, so that more varieties could be developed later as needed. The seventh animal in each group was clearly intended for sacrificial purposes, chapter 8, verse 20. Much later, the law of Moses plainly told which animals were to be regarded as clean in the Israelite system, Leviticus 11 and so forth. But we learned that all such distinctions were to be removed altogether in the Christian dispensation, Acts 10, 9-15, in 1 Timothy 4, verse 4. Verses 4 and 5 of chapter 7 say, For yet 7 days, and I will cause it to rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. God next tells Noah that it would still be 7 days before the flood would actually come upon the earth. This was probably for all of Noah's last-minute preparations, the placing of the animals in their stalls, feeding them and so forth, and probably one last warning to the world of the ungodly. God assured Noah, though, that after the 7 days, a tremendous rain would fall on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights until every living substance was destroyed from off the face of the earth. A worldwide rain lasting 40 days and 40 nights would be quite impossible under present atmospheric conditions. So this phenomenon required a completely different source of atmospheric waters than our present atmosphere has. We've already seen this source of water to be the waters above the firmament, the vast thermal blanket of invisible water vapor that maintained the greenhouse effect in the world before the flood, these waters above the firmament were somehow to condense and fall on the earth. God also revealed that everything on the dry land that had life would be literally wiped out from the face of the ground. This was to be no small matter. The earth was to be completely cleansed of its corruption in this global bath from heaven. The words here translated every living substance are koyeum, K-O-L-Y-E-Y-U-M, and mean literally all existence, or all that grows up. This concept does not limit itself to merely everything with the breath of life, but it seems to include plants as well as animals. The ground was to be so covered with water and devastated as to be made literally barren of vegetation. The lush forests and meadows of the world before the flood were all to be uprooted and washed away, and either to be buried in the sediments, where they would one day become the coal beds of the post-flood world, or else just decay and go back to dust. When God finished his instructions, Noah proceeded to do all that God commanded him. Just as he had done for over 100 years, here was the final test, the complete break with the world he had known all of his life, thrusting himself completely on God's mercy, and so again Noah obeyed without a shadow of hesitation. Verses 6 through 9 say, "And Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters was upon the earth. And Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him, into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean beasts, and of beasts that are not clean, and of fowls, and of everything that creepeth on the earth, there went in two and two into Noah, into the ark, the male and the female, as God had commanded Noah." The authors of this portion of Genesis, probably the sons of Noah, pause to clarify some of the facts of this solemn occasion, placing emphasis on Noah's age at this time. This date brought to an end the pre-flood age of the earth and began the post-flood age of the earth. And although the flood had not yet begun, the entrance of Noah's family and the animals into the ark cut them off once and for all from the world outside. From that moment on, the new order had begun for all those who had faith in the teaching and promise of God and acted on that belief. Very solemnly, in order to emphasize that every one of God's commandments were being carried out to the very letter, the record clearly describes all who entered the ark: Noah, his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, the clean animals, the unclean animals, the birds, and the creeping things. These were the ones which God had instructed Noah about, and all were now on the ark as planned. Each kind of animal was represented by a male and a female, so that the created kind could be preserved through the flood. Of each clean animal, there were two additional pairs and an extra individual for sacrificial purposes. Everything had been done as commanded, and the narrative here documents the same. Verses 10 through 12 say, "And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. The last grace period of 7 days had ended, and the time of the judgment had arrived. All the preparations for the flood were completed. The exact date was recorded, the second month, the 17th day of the month. And the date of the flood makes us wonder what calendar was in use. But it's probably impossible for us to be sure exactly what date this was. It may be that the measurement of time with this calendar began with creation. If so, the record here would be telling us that the flood came on earth 1,655 years, 1 month, and 16 days after creation. However, this is not something we can be sure of. But we can be sure that this account stresses that on a certain particular day, which marked the end of the pre-flood world, that on that one day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. It is very evident that the geophysical implications of this event are enormous, and it's vital to both the scientific and biblical understanding of Earth's history that we know what these statements mean. We've already seen that the water cycle before the flood was very different from the water cycle of the present day. Genesis 1, 6 through 8, 2 verse 5, 10 through 14, and 5 verse 5. The water cycle before the flood seems to have been controlled by two great reservoirs of water, which resulted from the great separation of the waters of the deep on the second day of creation into the waters above the firmament and the waters below the firmament. The firmament, which separated these two bodies of water, was the atmospheric heavens. The water above the firmament, also called waters above the heavens in Psalms 148, verse 4, these waters made up the vast vaporous canopy, which maintained the earth as a beautiful greenhouse, preventing cold temperatures and therefore preventing rain and windstorms. Being in the vapor state, it was invisible and completely transparent, but nevertheless, it contained vast quantities of water which could have extended far out into space. The waters below the firmament became what is referred to as the great deep or the great depth of water. This was water in the liquid state. This was visible to the first men as seas, Genesis 1:10, and rivers, Genesis 2:10-14. These rivers were not produced by runoff from rainfall, Genesis 2:5, but they came from controlled fountains or springs, evidently from deep-seated sources in or below the earth's crust. Proverbs 8:24 and Job 38:16 seem to refer to these fountains of the great depths. Such subterranean reservoirs were apparently all interconnected with each other, as well as with the surface seas into which the rivers drained, so that the entire complex constituted one great deep. The energy for repressuring and recycling the waters must have come from the earth's own subterranean heat placed there at creation. The entire system must have been a marvelous heat engine, which would have operated indefinitely as long as the earth's internal heat lasted, as long as the system of reservoirs, valves, governors, and conduits maintained their structure. Experts in the field of hydraulics and thermodynamics say that such a system is very feasible, and we know there is no reason to question the Creator's ability to provide this type of a system for the world He made. When the time for the destruction of the world arrived, all that was required was to bring the two deeps together again, as they had been when first created. The waters above the firmament must be condensed and be precipitated, and the waters below the crust must burst their bounds and escape again to the surface. Exactly how God brought about the great flood has been the cause for wide speculation among many students of the Bible. All sorts of catastrophes have been suggested. Sudden tiltings of the earth's axis, bombardment of the earth by meteorites or asteroids, a sudden slipping of the earth's crust, nuclear explosions caused by alien space travelers, gravitational and electromagnetic forces caused by a near miss of a wandering planet or comet, and many other theories. However, as we study the workings of God, we see that He has created a universe which is highly efficient in operation, and He will not interfere in this operation supernaturally unless the natural principles are incapable of accomplishing His purpose in a given situation. We should bear this in mind as we attempt to explain the cause of the Great Flood. There is no question that God could have caused all the events of the Great Flood miraculously, but scientific understanding of natural laws shows us that God could have started the reaction which caused the flood with some minor changes in nature's balance. The Bible states that the flood was caused by the bursting of the fountains of the great deep and the pouring down of torrential rains from heaven. These two events are sufficient in themselves to explain the flood and its effects without the need for supernatural creative miracles. The breaking up, or literally the cleaving open, of the fountains of the deep is mentioned first, and so this was evidently the first action which triggered the rest. These underground conduits somehow all developed uncontrollable fractures on the same day. For such a remarkable worldwide phenomenon, there must have been a worldwide cause. The most likely cause would seem to have been a rapid buildup and surge of intense pressure throughout the underground system, and this in turn would most likely cause a rapid rise in pressure throughout the entire system. God could have easily caused a miraculous upset in the balance of this great underground system to start a chain reaction and bring about a sequence of events which the Bible describes. And as we look at these great events described here in the Bible and see how they could have come about in a most natural way, it even strengthens more our belief in the story given in Genesis. That's our lesson. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.